Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
Another model, and this is something I've been thinking about lately, is like, okay, what if HR is over in commercial? And then if we have that, I guarantee you there's going to be a big portion of medical affairs like, oh, you can't do that. That's sin. That's awful. It's wrong. But I ask myself the question, well, why not? Why can't you do that?
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome to another episode of the Real Pharma Podcast. I am your host, Ian Wendt, joined by the ever effervescent Dr. Nari O. Good morning, Nari. Today, we're thrilled to have a distinguished guest, Iris Tam, a seasoned professional in the realm of health economics and outcomes research, otherwise known as HEOR, and value-based evidence generation in the pharma industry. With over three decades of experience in healthcare, including significant roles in hospital pharmacy, managed care, and the biopharmaceutical industry, Iris brings a wealth of knowledge to our discussion today. She has previously held pivotal leadership roles at organizations like Genentech, Qiagen, and Autonomy. In these roles, Iris has been instrumental in developing and implementing medical affairs strategies that not only support market access and product value, but also enhance patient quality of care. Her expertise extends to various domains such as medical communications, HEOR, formulary submissions, and scientific payer communications. Furthermore, Iris's commitment to advancing the field is evident through her long-term involvement with the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, AMCP, as the format executive committee, where she contributes significantly, including serving as the committee's chair. Iris's educational journey began with a bachelor's degree in microbiology and immunology from UC Berkeley, followed by a PharmD from UCSF. Her career has been marked not only by her professional achievements, but also by her courage to explore and embrace new directions in healthcare, a testament to her dynamic and forward-thinking approach. Today, as the Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs and HEOR at COAS Consulting Group, Iris continues to drive innovation and excellence in the pharmaceutical sector. Her diverse experiences and unique perspectives make her a valuable voice in discussions about the future of HEOR and values-based evidence in pharma. Please join us for a deep dive into the world of HEOR with Iris Tam. Welcome, Iris.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian and Nari, for having me.
So, Iris, let's dive right in. For people that are somewhat new to this field, how would you define HEOR and its significance in today's pharma landscape?
Well, in today's pharma landscape, HEOR is important because HEOR is a field of study where we are looking at measuring the value of a new innovation and the economics and how it impacts the healthcare sector in terms of economics. As we all know right now, the cost of healthcare is rising at a very unsustainable rate, and we have limited dollars to pay for healthcare. And so there has to be some choices to be made of what innovations and what treatments are going to be paid for, what is not going to be paid for. And health economics and outcomes research is intended to help with those decisions and inform those decisions by studying the value of healthcare innovation.
Thank you. That was a really great, succinct explanation of something I know is very, very complex. And we'll dive into that a little bit more with you throughout this episode.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that briefly, though, over time, has that evolved significantly? I mean, is HEOR playing a larger role in the minds and the work and the effort within pharma as they think about access and reimbursement? It seems like, based on the constraints that you talked about in terms of healthcare resource utilization and using those dollars efficiently, that must be the case. But am I right about that?
Yes, actually, the world of HEOR has been increasing. I'm seeing companies build capabilities with HEOR, and the activities around HEOR has increased over the past number of years. In fact, looking back, HOR was born probably around in the 90s with managed care. And I can tell you a personal story around HOR myself. I graduated from pharmacy school in the very early 90s, did a couple years of residencies, and then started to work. And I was working at the hospital then. I attended a conference, I can't remember which one, but they talked about the world of pharmacoeconomics. And that was the buzzword back then. And I started to meet people in pharmacoeconomics, and I learned about training programs like fellowships in pharmacoeconomics. And I thought, wow, this is a very interesting field. And I'm a big learner and I love to learn. And so I was very interested in learning more and perhaps going into that field. But I had just come out of school. I got my first mortgage and I couldn't afford to not work and go back to school or do a fellowship. And it's funny how fast forward 30 years later, and I'm sitting here in a podcast with people who think I'm an expert in HR and I've never went to school for it. But anyways, that's where it was born. It was born out of, I think, the movement around managed care, about not just paying fee for service and having organizations like the payers and clinical pharmacists starting to manage the pharmacy budgets. And so if you look back at the premier professional society for pharmacoeconomics and healthcare, health economics and outcomes research, ISPOR, the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research, they were established in 1995. So the field of HOR is about 30 years old now, I would say. And if you even look in the literature, papers around health economics and pharmacoeconomic studies started around the same time. And you see a very steep increase of papers being published in this type of studies. So definitely it's increased. And pharma companies are investing heavily into this field and hiring people who have the training to conduct these studies, to analyze these studies, to help inform the business.
So basically, the field was born just as you were getting ready to enter it. So you definitely are an expert who's been with HOR from the beginning, Iris. I think we can acknowledge that.
I was there on the side watching it.
I think Iris being very humble here. But a follow-on question for you is, it is called HEOR, Health Economics and Outcomes Research. Can you just explain the two components of the HEOR a little bit more?
Yeah, the health economics piece of it is really studying the economic impact of interventions and healthcare interventions. It's studying primarily, say, the affordability of drugs, and that's what we call budget impact. Can we afford it? As well as the value of the intervention or healthcare intervention, and is it worth it? Whereas the outcomes research piece of it, I think of, this is just me, Iris's definition, but I think of it more of studying things like quality of life and patient reported outcomes. And in some case, it might be just as important to look at caregiver burden and caregiver outcomes too. There are diseases that significantly impact family members and caregivers, not just the patient.
So in summary, the HE part is more about, does an intervention do what it's supposed to do? So is there value in it? And the second part is, can we afford it? So what's the budget impact? And then the outcomes research is more, what does it do or what does it mean for patients and their caregivers? Is that fair?
I think so, yes. And the first part, anything that can be expressed in a dollar sign.
Right. We're not talking about the clinical value, but is it worth investing in it?
Yeah. And hopefully the clinical will translate into some sort of economic or dollar sign.
So just building on that a little bit, you know, you mentioned some of the key components that kind of live under the HOR umbrella, for example, cost effectiveness analysis, budget impact analysis, quality of life, PROs or patient reported outcomes, and then real world evidence. I think maybe it was another one that would live there as well. So how is this changing the approach companies have in terms of drug development and marketing strategies? You know, this has obviously been an increasing area of focus for all the reasons that you mentioned. I just wonder what operationally or strategically does that look like from the pharma side of the table? Are they starting to think about these things earlier? Is this mostly post-marketing phase four? What can you help us understand in terms of how this is applied throughout the life cycle of the drug?
Yeah, Ian, you just mentioned for pharma companies to think about these things earlier in their drug development program, I think it's key. I would say historically, the clinical development part of the organization is thinking about running those trials, right, going from phase one to phase two to phase three. And their finish line and their goal is to get it to the FDA so that FDA can review it and approve it. And that's their finish line. And so that's how they design their trials. And today, more and more, hopefully, these companies and these clinical development organizations are thinking beyond the FDA and thinking about, well, what evidence do my internal partners, i.e. commercial, need when we're ready to launch the product and sell and get uptake? And so the smart companies are thinking about that very early. And I call this payer evidence planning, because at the end of the day, you're trying to get those healthcare decision makers, those population health decision makers, to review your product, see value in it, cover it, and then reimburse for it. So a pharma company has the opportunity to build all these things into your clinical trials and get more out of your clinical trials than just the bare minimum for FDA approval. And so there are pivotal studies now that are looking at other outcomes, such as patient-reported outcomes and quality of life or patient preferences or other healthcare impact, like there might be a disease where the treatment can decrease the number of times the patient has an acute exacerbation and showing up in the ER or getting hospitalized. And if you measure those things early on, you'll have the data when you launch. Because if you don't, and I think more often than not, we don't have it at launch, then you get the drug approved, you throw it over the fence to commercial, and then you let the rest of the organization pick up from there. And you're already behind the eight ball, right? And so you're waiting for your medical affairs, your HR teams, your market access to identify what evidence payers need to make those decisions and then run those studies. And it takes more time, takes more resources, and the data may not be perfect. And usually it's not perfect.
So Iris, we discussed on a previous episode with Corey Stout some examples of drugs that were approved, but then weren't really able to launch successfully because of issues with payers or insurers. And so you mentioned, you know, we used to think we get it approved by FDA and then everything's good. It's just a matter of how you market it or how you discuss the clinical data with your stakeholders. But to your point, if payers, as another very important stakeholder group, don't accept the HER data or other non-clinical data, then you can also experience a failed launch, essentially. Can you give some examples of maybe how you have worked in the past with clients where it went really well with what you were telling them or what you were advising them on, and they built that into a launch plan versus where that didn't happen? And again, we don't need specific examples, but it seems very obvious now where we are that payers are important and HER is important, but we still see examples of where it just doesn't work out. Is it, in your opinion, more because it's just not foreseeable or because it's not being planned for?
I think it's partly it's not being planned for. So companies usually don't start thinking about the payers until it's so close to launch. You're already past that point of the phase three study design, right? So if you want to think about what the payers need, you need to start probably at around when you're finishing up phase two and well before when you have established and locked down the protocol for phase three. And that's the sweet spot, I think, where you can ask for more data or ask for more outcomes to measure and think about what the payer might need and what can we get out of this phase three study that we're thinking about. In my role here at COAS, I've talked to some clients where they were very forward thinking, and there was one particular one where we were planning on doing what I just talked about, payer evidence planning. They hadn't started their phase three study yet, but they wanted to bake into the phase three study outcomes that would matter to payers. So we had drawn out this whole plan of doing it. Unfortunately, their product didn't do well. It didn't read out positively in phase two. So we never got to phase three, but the intent was there.
That's music to my ears. You know, as the commercial person, you kind of use the phrase, like sometimes there's this clinical development effort that the end goal is really just to get some approval. And then you said you kind of throw it over the fence to commercial and say, good luck, right? That's probably largely the way the industry operated 20 or 30 years ago. It might be being a little unfair to our clinical development friends, but that definitely was a dynamic that existed. And I think that may be changing today. But I think let's say the design, management, execution of the studies themselves on the HEOR side, I'm imagining that function lives within the medical affairs team, but also would probably require a lot of cross-functional collaboration with their market access partners, right? To make sure that they're aligned on, as you said, what are the other outcomes that we can get out of a phase three effort just to kind of maximize the value that we're getting from that data. That's going to have to happen years before your PDUFA date and a lot of cross-functional good teamwork. Am I thinking about that the right way? And are there alternative kind of approaches that you think could be considered as well?
Well, you mentioned that HR teams typically live in the medical affairs function. And I think that is probably very common. But I've also seen variations in that. Most of the times I see them living within medical affairs. And then they work on projects pretty much most of the time is post-marketing. If the company can bring HR people in or build that function prior to launch, then that's great. But then I've also seen HR groups reporting into commercial and reporting into market access.
Interesting. Okay.
I've seen that, and I've seen a combination of two. The evidence generation, the technical people are on medical affairs, but there's also an individual or a function over in commercial or market access that actually focuses on the strategy and liaise with the medical affairs HR. I think also clinical development may have some of these functions. I don't know if they call it HR, but people who look at patient-reported outcomes, quality of life, things like that.
Do you think there's a model that works better than others, Aris?
Well, I actually have a model in my head that I would love to propose.
Please do.
People might think I'm a little nuts. I honestly see HUR exists because of market access. There are a lot of reasons for having HUR, but I think the primary reason is to help the company with market access. And so either if they live in medical affairs, there needs to be much, much better collaboration and alignment between health economics and outcomes research that function in medical affairs with the market access commercial function over on the commercial side. I know there's a firewall, and there's a firewall for a reason, but despite the firewall, there's ways to collaborate and align so that you're rowing in the same direction because we're all in the same boat. And I see that as a big hurdle and a big problem in industry across the board where there's challenges, issues. They use the firewall as a reason for it. Maybe there's politics and turf battles, things like that, that doesn't help. Another model, and this is something I've been thinking about lately, is like, okay, what if HR is over in commercial? And then if we have that, I guarantee you there's going to be a big portion of medical affairs like, oh, you can't do that. That's sin. That's awful. It's wrong. But I ask myself the question, well, why not? Why can't you do that? Why can't you have a research group in medical affairs to focus on generating evidence and thinking about what the marketplace within the health plans and the payers and these, again, population health decision makers need, and have them do their work there and generate evidence for that purpose.
Is that a trend that you think you're seeing in the industry with more, let's say, commercial ownership of some of the HEOR functions? Or is this more of your proposal you think would be a best practice to consider? I'm just wondering, or how progressive is that idea in terms of what's actually taking place? And are we seeing any shifts that look more like what you're proposing?
I have seen a few companies that actually have their HR functions within commercial and within their market access and reporting under the head of market access.
Yeah. Well, I'm sold because I'm a commercial person, so it all sounds great to me. There might be other opinions out there, I'm sure. So let's switch focus a little bit and look through the payer lens. Obviously, as you mentioned, you know, they're a key stakeholder here and really drive the overall business need behind all the HEOR efforts. What are some of the key elements that the payers look for in HEOR studies, really, to make formulary or access decisions? Is there some hierarchy? How are those gated? What does kind of a best practice look like in terms of a value proposition to a payer? And I certainly understand this is going to vary to some degree by the therapeutic area you're operating in and kind of the competitive landscape and a few other variables, I'm sure. But I wonder, from a high level, if I'm looking at this through the payer's eyes, what's going to be most impactful for me in making my decisions?
Yeah, you know, it's funny how HR, I think, was designed primarily with the payers in mind, that the payers would be the primary consumers of HR evidence. But unfortunately, payers realize that every new drug that comes out is going to be more expensive than anything in the past, right? And so it's very hard to find a true cost effectiveness, or it's going to be hard to say that a drug is going to save them cost. Because at the end of the day, the payers, yes, they're looking at efficacy. Yes, they're looking at safety. But I honestly believe that the number one they're looking at is the economics. They're looking at the dollar sign. They're looking at how much they're going to have to spend, how much can they save. And payers understand that new drugs are going to be expensive. But what they want to know is, if they pay for that higher price tag, what are they going to get in return? Are they going to get better outcomes than they have in the past? And then they'll understand, yes, it's going to cost more, but it's better for patients. Or is it going to offset other costs? Like, for example, if you use this drug, then you don't need some sort of organ transplant down the road, something very significant like that. They're probably very realistic that most drugs that come out is not going to entirely save costs, i.e. that you spend the dollars on the drug and you're going to save even more money and offset the entire cost of that drug somewhere else. That's probably not usually the case. But they want to know what value they're going to get, whether it's the clinical value or some major cost offsets elsewhere, or decreased hospitalizations or no ER visits. And there are some drugs that do that. But then the majority of drugs, of many drugs, they're just incremental improvements. They might be coming out in a crowded drug class. So how many X inhibitors within a particular drug class, how many of those do we need now when you're now the second, third, fourth, fifth of the same class coming out? So that's really challenging. I think also a challenge in the payer space for pharma companies is, a pharma company will go to the payers with their pivotal trials, right? And the pivotal trials show significant difference, statistically significant difference in certain outcomes. And payers' response has been, oh, well, those pivotal trials, that's a low bar to us, even though they're randomized controlled. It's what you guys do to get FDA approval, and that's a low bar. Or they'll say, that's not my patient population. That's a very controlled environment. Well, those patients aren't like the patients I have in my membership. My patients are sicker and older and whatever other pushback they give. And so you go out as a drug company and you go out and develop real world evidence, right? In your HR organization. And then you go to them with that. And then they'll poke holes with your HR evidence and say, well, it's confounded, it's not controlled, it's, you know, this or that. And so that's the real challenge for pharma, is pharma is spending so much money generating HR evidence, and payers, unfortunately, have the luxury to consider it or not. And honestly, payers think that anything that comes from a pharma company is already biased. So this is a well-known thought.
So it's a little bit of a catch-22. You can't not have the data, and it's a lot of work to generate that data. As you mentioned, it's not like a clinical study where at launch, most of your work is done. It continues post-launch, and the goalpost keeps changing in some cases. And then even if you have that data, the payers can still say, still don't like it. So what is your advice? I mean, as you said, for some drugs where you can only prove incremental improvement, that's a hard bar to clear. But even, let's say, if you have an innovative drug and you're first to market in a field where there are not a lot of treatment options or intervention options, it's very hard usually to prove hard outcomes because it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of patience in studies to prove that. So time's not on your side either. How do you envision that being managed in the future? Because this is not something that pharma companies can do without, right? It's a requirement pretty much. But with the challenges that you just outlined, are there best practices to consider now to really rethink how we do HEOR?
I think in HEOR, there are other challenges just within the field, I think, right? There's the challenge of usually HEOR don't get the millions of dollars that you spend on doing a clinical trial. And so when the organization wants to generate real world evidence, what do we use? We use a lot of claims database because medical and pharmacy claims databases, there's a lot of data there, but that data or claims were meant to, their administrative claims data, and the purpose for them is to pay claims, right? It's not meant to do clinical research. But we use it a lot and try to make inferences out of the data, but it's not perfect. And there's another set of data that's out there, and that's the EHR, electronic health records, and EMR, electronic medical records. And this whole health IT thing came about in the early 2000s. And a lot of our medical records and our medical information, health information, are in electronic databases. But the problem today is all those databases are not interoperable. So I still see a lot of studies being done using administrative claims because the data that we have in our health records is not consistent across the board. And I'm a little flabbergasted that we are so advanced, we have AI and everything, and yet we can't get our US healthcare system on the same electronic database. I think it's quite sad.
Yeah, actually, I was going to be one of my next questions to you is kind of explore the role of technology. You've already touched on a few things, obviously, that are important, the claims database and EHRs, while a step in the right direction versus paper-based charts, it's fragmented, right? You have different systems that aren't integrated or don't talk to each other. So you either have to do a big integration effort across different data sets, or you have to look at data sets individually, which may not give a complete picture of what's going on out there. But I also wonder, and maybe this falls or is more aligned to PRO and other real world evidence generation efforts, but I wonder if there's things like wearables and some of the other technologies that are very recent, but becoming increasingly important that can help with some of that research. So we're not only relying on claims databases, for example. Have you seen any companies do anything interesting there? Because it seems like an opportunity. Now your Apple Watch can obviously take your pulse rate and a variety of other things. There's other wearables that do a variety of different things. Have you seen any companies that are kind of out in front and using those for any of this type of work?
I don't have an example that I'm aware of where they're using wearables and doing research off of it. I think it's a great idea. all the different wearables and the apps that are out there is pretty amazing. I use a couple of them myself. And they can be a powerful tool to collect more information from more patients. There might be other issues and challenges that I'm not an expert on, whether it's HIPAA. Everyone always says HIPAA. That seems to be the first thing that people throw out as a hurdle for everything. But you also see new technologies in digital therapies. And my understanding is there are different levels of digital health. There's digital health, I think it's very generic, and that some of those apps and devices any of us can use and get on our own, whereas a true digital therapeutic, there are a few that are FDA approved, right? You actually go through FDA approval. But I think those are possible mechanisms to advance the world of research. We were actually engaged with a client where we discussed the use of like developing an app to capture, say, migraines, because you can't detect migraines in the claims database, but to use that to collect it straight from the patient in real time. Unfortunately, I'm not personally aware of any specific example that is actually being implemented right now.
Yeah, it seems like digital therapeutics would play a role there if they're not already playing a role. Although I still think that's yet to be proven in terms of who's figured that out, especially from a reimbursement perspective, right? You know, the payers don't want to reimburse for digital therapeutics. And there's been a couple notable examples that had a lot of funding and didn't do so well. A pair comes to mind most recently. So I think their day will come, but I think we haven't quite got there yet. But I think that could be a great tool for this type of work in the future.
So Iris, I wanted to ask something a little bit different, which is, as a global pharmaceutical company, usually you want to launch your drug not just in the US, which of course is still the biggest market, but also in other regions. What are some of the considerations for HEOR with regards to launch success ex-US?
Well, first, my experience has not included, I haven't worked in the global world, but I am aware that companies that have a global presence and marketing in globally will have global HR functions. And there, I think in many other countries, especially when they have a one-payer system, HR actually plays a bigger role. So we are all familiar with NICE in the UK and many other countries in Europe, Canada, Australia. The HR function has a more definitive role, in that each country has very specific requirements for submitting information, not just about the clinical aspects of the product, but some sort of economic assessment. And in those countries, the company needs to put together some sort of economic package, a model of some sort to submit. And again, I haven't worked specifically in those areas and it's not my area of expertise, but I know that's what those global functions have to do.
And I'm sure that with similar efforts in at least some of the European countries as what we see in the US, for instance, with IRA, the budget pressures are the same everywhere and probably will increase with aging populations and more expensive healthcare utilization. So I'm sure that that will also become a focus in the future as well. And we'll just bring you back in 10 or 20 years and then you can talk to us about the global aspect as well.
Yeah. In the US, you know, because we have such a fragmented payer system and hundreds of decision makers, whereas in these other countries, it's just one major one and maybe some smaller ones.
Yeah. Another question, Iris, and I think you touched on it a little bit earlier. What are some of the ethical considerations when it comes to HR research? Just like we want to adhere to the highest ethical standards with clinical research and really make sure that patient rights are preserved and patients are at the center of what we do, is there something equivalent to consider in HEOR research?
Yeah, in conducting real-world evidence, if you are conducting, say, a prospective pragmatic trial in the clinic setting where it's not as controlled in a randomized control trial, you still have to think about, you know, patient rights and getting informed consent and the such. When I think about ethical considerations for HEOR, I think one of the more major issues, not so much about patient rights or safety, it's about the conduct of the studies, in that the research that's done under this umbrella of HOR can be done, and then if you don't like the results, you don't have to disclose it. And that's the way it is today. You don't have to go and present it at a conference. You don't have to publish it in a peer-reviewed journal. But if it's positive, then you can. Then you're going to go out there and you're going to present it and you're going to publish it. So that is, I think that is one thing to think about related to your question. Whereas in clinical trials today, you know, they need to be, they're fully disclosed. There's a registry for it, clinicaltrials.gov, and there's not something similar. I think there's been a movement and people talk about it, and maybe there's even a registry for it, but it's not something that is done universally like it is for clinical trials.
That's a great point. It's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, right? So the whole truth is important here.
That sets up a bit of a dilemma for companies though, right? So just to take the other side of the table on this one, you can understand from a pure commercial perspective why you may not be proactively communicating results of some HOR study that you've done if they're not favorable to your brand. I think we all understand the why behind that. And then the question is, ethically, you know, should you be allowed to pick and choose which data you present? Because that might be relevant information that that stakeholders would benefit from, whether it's, you know, whoever it might be, maybe it's the payer, maybe it's the patient. But if we legislated some requirement that you had to disclose those trial results, and I'm not arguing against that or for that, but if that's what we ended up doing, I could see a situation where companies would be very conservative in terms of what trials they fund and what work they do. Because if the risk is, well, gee, this might pay off, but it could be detrimental to the brand, maybe I just don't do it at all. And then we end up with less information. That's not a real solution to the situation, but I can see that dynamic developing. So I'm not sure legislating that they are required to disclose this information is a perfect solution, I guess is all I'm saying.
Yeah. If there was some law that says you have to disclose every research project that you embark on, I can see that really shutting down on a lot of that activity.
But maybe it also leads to higher standards and more standardization across what is acceptable and what's the minimum level of entry, so to speak, for what data we even want to consider.
Well, you can see Nari and I are on opposite sides of the table on this issue, I think. But I think it's a great topic to bring up because all stakeholders kind of have interest in this data, you know, no matter what it says. Sometimes your interest is for different reasons. So I think that is something I'm sure companies are thinking about, and maybe bioethicists out there are thinking about as well, because we probably need some help there to figure out what the right answer is. So professionals that are looking to enter or advance in the field of HEOR, and hopefully we have a few of them listening right now, what are the skills and experiences that you believe are most valuable, or what advice might you give them to kind of move forward in their career as such an important function?
I precept a lot of pharmacy students. I hire interns and try to mentor them through their career development. And if they tell me that they are interested in HOR, then, you know, after pharmacy school, I might say, well, you might want to think about pursuing a fellowship in HOR or go back to college and get another degree in health economics and whatnot. But in terms of the future of HOR in general, I think for companies, I think it's doing it smarter and not just doing more of it. I recall in 2005, I attended the ISPOR conference for the first time because I had a colleague who talked me into doing a session that we had done at AMCP. And she said, let's repeat it at ISPOR. And I'm like, okay. So I show up at ISPOR and my jaw just dropped and my eyes were like this. And I was like, wow, what is this world? Because there I saw so many sessions on HR concepts and principles, and you go to the poster session and there's thousands of posters. And I was like, wow, I didn't know that there's this whole, I mean, I knew, but I didn't realize how big this world of HOR researchers and evidence generation was until I got to that conference. And I was like, wait a second, So HOR is meant to support products so that they get covered and paid for. And I was already very involved with AMCP at that time. I'm like, wait a second. Those people at AMCP need to see this stuff, but they don't talk to each other. And they don't, why aren't these organizations talking? And that's when I realized that there's a lot of work getting done in HOR, but who's looking at it? Who's paying attention to it? Who's highly regarding it? And the people that we need to do that are not doing that. It's not happening. And so when I say we need to be smarter at it and not just do more of it, it's really being very strategic for a company, figuring out what it is that is going to move the needle and not just generating a lot of stuff. Because I've seen it over and over again. Companies are just generating a lot of stuff and it doesn't move the needle.
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably a lot of areas and things that companies do that you could apply that same advice to. But certainly this is one in particular that I agree. You know, I think throwing more at the problem isn't always the solution. I think being very strategic and having those insights, planning ahead, doing this maybe earlier in the development stage of the drug all pays dividends down the road. And hopefully there's some companies figuring that out and others that are on their way to doing that. I think it's easy to find examples maybe of what good looks like and what maybe not as good looks like, but it is a little bit of trial and error. It's a moving target, right? The payers, who you're interacting with and who you're trying to influence and how you can influence them, I think changes over time as well. So, you know, I cut companies a little bit of slack because it's a tough environment, I think, to operate in.
To your point, Ian, you're right. We should cut the companies some slack too, because like I said before, payers have the luxury to use whatever information to support their decisions. And I can say that because I've been on that side and I've seen it happen. I used to work for a payer. I ran P&T when I was in the hospital. So I have that mentality of that pharmacist of like, okay, what is my main goal at work, right? What is my mission? My mission is to contain costs. And so that's my motivation. And so payers, they can make their formulary decisions or their prior auth decisions based on whatever it is that they want. So people always ask me, well, do they look at NICE reports? Do they look at ICER reports? And I'm like, my general response is, if it supports their position, then they'll use it. And if it doesn't, then they won't use it.
Just like us, just like on the pharma side too, right?
Do you ever do postmortems with your clients and see what actually worked well and what didn't go so well? And what do we learn from that for the next mission? Or are the cases so different that it doesn't really help since the environment also keeps changing? But you said it doesn't always help to just generate more data or do more of the same. So how do we learn what actually works? How do we become smarter?
Yeah, so actually, I have a client where we're working on a HR project and it wasn't as great as we had hoped. But at the very least, it is informative. It can be used at least as an internal resource to inform future strategies. So one of my suggestions is to the client is, well, I know it's not perfect and all rosy, but we can use this to inform your business strategy and your evidence generation strategy. So now that we know what it looks like given this project, what else can you do to shore up your value story so that maybe in a couple of years from now, we do this project that is going to look different because the evidence is just not there, right? We believe that a product will have certain benefits for patients and deliver certain outcomes. And oftentimes, common sense-wise, theoretically, it makes sense. We just don't have the hard data to prove it.
So we've had a really great discussion with you, Iris. And I've learned a little bit more about HOR. So thank you for that. And I hope our audience has too. I want to close out with what we ask every one of our guests, because every guest has a unique and interesting path and really has been a pathfinder in their field. Is there anybody or anything that has stayed with you throughout your career as good advice or kind of a guiding principle that has been with you and informed your career?
Yeah, I think so. When I set out after graduation, my goal was to become a pharmacy director in a hospital. And I did all the things to get myself there. So my first job, I was well on that path. And that was my passion. And I was very content. But then an old preceptor called and recruited me into managed care. And then my career has taken multiple detours since then. And I didn't plan it this way. I never dreamt of working for pharma companies. I thought as a pharmacist, I'd be selling my soul. I work for a pharma company, but here I am. So anyways, my mentor, his name is Bob. I remember him calling me and saying, hey, Iris, you know, you want to come work for me and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, Bob, I don't know anything about managed care. And he says, Iris, you're a great pharmacist. I can teach you everything. And so when I first started with him, he sat down and taught me managed care 101. And thanks to him, that was the beginning of the evolution of my career and the path that I've taken. And what I learned from that was just learning on the job and just using common sense and just doing the right thing, having the courage to take on some unmet business need and figure it out as I go. And I feel like when I look back at my career, that's exactly what I've done. I definitely didn't plan the last 20 plus years of my career at all. It was just looking to help what needed to be done and filling that gap.
Yeah, I love that idea, you know, just jumping in and doing what needs to be done. Sometimes that does require figuring it out as you go along. But if you're confident in your abilities and you have the right support team, most of us are capable of doing that. You have to overcome your fears to jump in and actually take that on. And most of the time it works out, and it clearly has for you. So thanks for joining us today. It was a great discussion. I, you know, always enjoy learning from you and picking your brain a little bit when I have tough questions, and really appreciate the work that you do over with COAS Consulting, great group of folks, and really have been very valuable for me in my role for sure.
It was lovely talking to you, Iris. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really fun.
All right. Well, it was great to reconnect with Iris. Just a wealth of information. As we were thinking about this topic, HEOR, she was literally the first name that came to mind for me. And I think she made a great point that increasingly this is becoming HEOR and evidence generation, kind of the value-based evidence generation, let's say, is becoming more and more important as a trend that's been going on for, I guess, decades now. But, you know, I think we've all heard of it, but we all may not be experts in that area. Certainly, I'm not either. It is increasingly important, as I mentioned, and important throughout the entire life cycle of your drug, of your brand, and really building those relationships with medical or clinical, wherever the HEOR function might exist, building those relationships early on and developing a collaborative approach to the design of these studies is just so critical. And I think anybody not doing that, we should be thinking about best practices there and how to do more of that, because it does pay dividends throughout the entire life of the drug. Catching up later is probably not a good strategy. Starting earlier certainly seems to be a theme that she was advocating for. So that's one of the key takeaways I had.
I agree. I think the cross-functional or collaborative approach that Iris focused on, that stood out to me as well. And then the second key takeaway for me was, how do we make sure that the work that HEOR does, which is very, very important, as you mentioned, actually reaches the right audience at the right time in the right way? So having done all that work, you want to make sure that it actually has an impact. So how do we better understand what our targets want, the payers? And since they don't have to really accept the data if they don't want to, what's the best way to really anticipate that and build that into the evidence generation strategy?
Yeah, I think that gets back to working smarter. It's not just about a volume of data that you generate, but is it the right data for the right audience and at the right time? But I think that's always the kind of the North Star to kind of guide these efforts.
Another great episode, and I'll see you next time, Ian.
Thanks so much, Nari. See you next time.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.